Hello and welcome to The Wealth Chat, brought to you by SG Kleinwort Hambrose. I'm Jonathan Speck, Senior Partner at Mourant in Jersey.
I'm Jonathan Needham, Head of Trust and Succession Planning for Societe Generale Private Banking.
And I'm Simon Kleiss, Head of Private Client Trust for SG Kleinwort Hambrose.
In today's episode, we're talking about the ruthless elimination of risk in wealth transfer and how do you stop it going wrong?
You need the processes put in place before it happens. The more planning that can go into what happens when I can no longer look after myself, the more chance you've got of actually having a sensible solution.
We've moved into a world now where some people are choosing not to marry, having life partners who mean the same to them as a spouse, but older generations and maybe even, for example, the trust don't treat them in the same way.
Then suddenly this huge sum of money landed literally on their doorstep. And I had an interesting conversation with them and said, well, how did that make you feel? Just trying to understand from an emotional perspective, what was the impact? They summed it up in one word, petrified.
To help us explore this, we are joined by Graham Kleiner, a partner at Charles Russell Speechless in London, and by Melody Munro, an associate at Farrer & Co., also in London. Graham Kleiner is an acknowledged expert in the field of private client litigation, and Melody is a talented litigator from Farrer & Company, also specialising in this area. Melody, can I ask you about wealthy families? They want your advice. Where do you start? Do you want to define what their objectives are? Is that a good starting point?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head. Objectives. Why are we setting this up and what are we hoping to achieve? It's helpful whenever setting up a structure to ask that question and really, really ask it. Some people kind of have an idea of, oh, I want to pass my wealth down, full stop, great. Well, why do you want to pass it down? Who do you want to benefit? How do you want it to be managed? Do you have a family company that you want to preserve? Do you want to allow future generations to enjoy it? This generation, the next generation? Really nailing down into all of those kind of questions is absolutely key. And making sure that everyone is clear on them, having conversations with family members, speaking to advisors, looking at all the considerations that you can at that stage really helps set a structure up on the right footing.
So you've got to get to know your client, to use an old-fashioned expression. How do you actually go about doing that in practice?
It may sound trite, but a conversation is the simplest way to do it. Meeting your client, meeting members of a family that you're going to be working with is the best way to do that at a preliminary stage. And then each family will be different. There's no such thing as a typical family. Some people may want to have regular meetings. Some people may want to communicate in writing. Often, some sort of governing document can be really helpful to make sure you know from the outset clearly and with the benefit of advice what the wishes of the wealth creator were.
So you talk about, Melody, a governing document, perhaps in the context of trusts. Is that something that you would call a letter of wishes?
Yes, it is. They're often quite controversial in the trust world, the amount of time we spend arguing over quite what a letter of wishes means takes books to write about. But yeah, letter of wishes are very typical in the trust sense and often will be updated as a trust progresses and as circumstances change. But they're vital to understanding the intentions of a settlor law and, in fact, the way a trust should be interpreted and acted on by the trustees. And
do you have strict rules about what you think must go in to that kind of governing document?
There's no set formula for a letter of wishes. It can be personal to whoever is setting it up. It's helpful, though, to have put some proper thought into it and to have looked at the structure, you know, the trust, its terms, and how you would like that to be implemented in the future. And really, the clearer you can be and the more bespoke you can be, the better. I mean, the thing about a letter of wishes is it's not binding, though it's obviously a very important document and it can be updated, but that's not a good excuse for doing a lackluster first draft. Proper thought and time really should go into these documents, although there is no strict format.
Graham, I'm really worried about these documents because I think they could be a recipe for tricky litigators like you to come on later and have fun with them. Do they become a straitjacket for the family? Do they create a problem?
Well, letters of wishes in particular are odd documents in the sense that they don't form part of the constitution of the trust. It's a document that sits outside and is actually, the courts have found repeatedly, they're private documents. So later beneficiaries won't necessarily see them. But they do go to the purpose why the assets have been transferred to the trustees, and they will be a guide to the trustees, but they shouldn't be slavishly followed. And in fact, all of the jurisdictions use that term, they shouldn't be slavishly followed. However, they are a guide. And on top of that, there is recent, very recent case law that they actually also might be an aid to construction of the reasons why this structure was established in the first place.
So when you say an aid to construction,
yes,
let me pretend I'm not a lawyer at least. Or so, is that something to do with building a house?
Similar, but no, they're an aid to the courts because a lot of these trusts are written in terms where everything's at the discretion of the trustee. And so it is difficult to understand just looking at those trust documents, who's meant to get what? What are the real wishes that lay behind this? And it's sort of a flexible way in which family members or wealth creators can put their assets into trust, but to regularly update or periodically update the trustees as to how they wish it to be administered without being binding necessarily on the trustees. But the first letter of wishes actually now is looking to be more important than ever before because the courts are saying, well, but what was the purpose at the outset of this structure? And the purpose needs to be looked at the time it was created. So whilst settlors and other wealth creators can update their letters of wishes to give updates in terms of the way they wish the trust to be administered and who's to benefit and what sort of things they would like to be thought about by the trustees without being a straitjacket, it's something that you do need to give quite a lot of thought to at the outset. So they shouldn't be just a pro forma document, which is produced by a lawyer, for instance, which is sort of off a precedent list, and then you just fiddle around with it. They've real thought's got to be given at the outset and periodically thereafter. So I think whilst they're not a straitjacket, they are an important document.
John, as a trustee, you must see these letters of wishes all the time. You get involved at the outset in helping people to put their governing thoughts down.
Yes, indeed. And you know, as Graham alluded to, I think that they are a document that requires a lot of forethought and planning around them because you're planning for the unexpected to some degree. Many family heads regard their expression of wishes as the only means sometimes of conveying their purpose in terms of their wealth going forwards, which is a little naive because that's used as an excuse not to have the face-to-face conversations quite often during their lifetime, which is a key source of a lot of litigation and many a family dispute, I think.
Can I ask you a question about that, John? I mean, Graham, as a litigator, very helpfully told us that generally these documents are private and aren't necessarily shown to family members who weren't involved in putting them together in the first place. But what's your experience as a seasoned practitioner?
My experience is that's fine until something goes wrong inevitably, and then the veil of confidentiality around letters of wishes, at least in part, gets to a degree lifted as a minimum because they will be quite often used in evidence to support a particular line of argument in terms of why did my father or my mother or my grandmother or grandfather set things up in a particular way or have this particular requirement in terms of how they wanted their wealth handled going forward. So I think they're very helpful in terms of a trustee, as Graham highlights, but also I think if the expectation of a family or they're not particularly well informed around the history of the wishes, and that hasn't been previously communicated, they can be a significant source of disagreement. And that's an area where people need to be very cautious in terms of what they say, but also equally be very well prepared and prepare their family in advance.
So communication is key.
Absolutely. You know, you always get the patriarch or matriarch who believes, A, they're not going to necessarily pass away at any point in time, B, that their family don't need to know because it's something that's very privileged and private to them. And those are actually, in terms of planning, fundamental mistakes and actually serve no other purpose really than to cause ultimately a level of dysfunction within a family.
I find it hard to believe, Simon. I mean, you've been a trustee now for what? Is it really 37 years?
Be 39 years this year.
39. And I think I've known you for most of that time. You must have seen all things along these lines going wrong. But how do you make them go well? Do you look at the risks at the outset? Do you talk about risk so that you can identify where things might go off the rails?
Yeah, you mentioned risk. I always talk about threats to that wealth and what can go wrong. So when I'm speaking to clients, I'm quite often talking about the what ifs. What if that happened? And what if this happened? And how do you feel? We mentioned about expect the unexpected, that you did suddenly pass away. How would your family cope? You know, your children, are they financially sophisticated or not? What relationships might they be in? We know that families nowadays are complicated. We mentioned they're different, but they're also very complicated. You know, I've seen cases where actually some of the wealth creators are on their sort of third and fourth marriage, you know, children from those different marriages. So that is a potential for some sort of conflict. So I guess using your word is a risk. Going back to what we've all been saying, talking through which of their sort of children, you know, are financially sophisticated, could they cope with the burden, you know, of wealth if they did have to agree to, you know, to step into the shoes of the wealth creator. And also, you know, getting a good understanding of from the settlement, it's just sort of outreaching. It's not necessarily a risk. But in terms of how long do they want this wealth to last, you know, as well. And that will help us plan, because you so often hear practitioners say, you know, wealth creators created all this wealth in their lifetime, and that next generation comes and destroys that wealth. So that is a risk or a threat. So just knowing how long should that wealth last for before it gets sort of distributed amongst the family members.
Well, having a real tightly defined set of values or principles, whatever you might call them, you find that always helps.
Yes, of course.
Gosh, well, there's a straight answer from a straight-talking trustee. Melody, one of my favourite box sets is Modern Family. I don't know about you. I don't think there is such a thing as a normal family, certainly not where lots of wealth is involved. What sort of issues do you see coming out of what we might call the modern family today?
I think there are a great many issues that can come out of it. And while it's helpful to have a clearly defined set of values, and we were talking about the importance of that for even understanding how a structure should be run at all, there can be problems that come from that, particularly intergenerationally. We see more and more often now families where there are multiple marriages, as you were saying, multiple children, but also differences in values between generations. We've moved into a world now where some people are choosing not to marry, having life partners who mean the same to them as a spouse, but older generations and maybe even, for example, the trust don't treat them in the same way. We see people adopting children, fostering children, unofficially adopting their partner's children from a previous marriage. And one of the problems, particularly with children now, is that many people are choosing or unable to have them. And you see schisms in families when one branch may have many, many children and therefore feel entitled to a large chunk of the pot to pass down as their wealth creator wanted. But another branch of the family maybe couldn't or chose not to have children and feel really left out of the structure and unable to have a say in the wealth that was created. And they really do feel like they have some sort of claim to as part of the family. There's no easy way to resolve these issues other than, I think, people talking about how they feel, getting together and trying to come up with practical solutions with the help of their advisors.
So it comes back to effective communication once again. You're a fan of communication.
I am a fan of communication. Yeah, I think secrecy really only leads to mistrust, and mistrust leads to problems.
Yeah, one of the most fascinating problems that I've seen is dealing with, I think, what we politely call genetic material. I don't know if that's anything that you guys have had experience of. handling disputes or issues around genetic material, but it certainly gives rise to the potential for problems. I've even had a case of what, would you believe there's a term for this, called spurgling, which is the theft of genetic material and the use of that to make somebody pregnant so that they become a member of the family. And that leads to disputes.
Fortunately, not something I've come across.
Not directly.
Hopefully none of us will, quite.
It just shows you the scope for things to go badly wrong. But John, tell me, again, as a really experienced trustee, wealth manager, do you know what I mean by glue removal?
Yes, indeed. I think the you know, every family structure has at its head a principle, for want of a better expression, be it the mother, father, grandmother, grandfather, whoever it may be. They, during their lifetime, have this immense level of control, both emotional and sometimes financial, and normally both, over the family, and hold court pretty well over how the family operates. When they pass, however, that creates an enormous void. And if no thought as to preparation for that day has been given, that's not a comfortable position for people to be in. I remember meeting a family of actually three Spanish brothers, actually. They were eighth generation, had lived a very privileged life. The family wealth had always gone down the female line. And they got to a position about 10 or so years ago where there were no more female members. And they inherited a huge sum of money. They knew that they had had a privileged upbringing. They knew they had had a very good education. They knew that they were well looked after during their formative years. And then suddenly this huge sum of money landed literally on their doorstep. And I had an interesting conversation with them and said, well, how did that make you feel? Just trying to understand from an emotional perspective, what was the impact? They summed it up in one word: petrified. They felt really let down in some respects by their forebears for not educating them around what wealth, not necessarily in terms of scale, but in terms of scope of wealth, how that impacts on a family, what are the thoughts they need to think about, the vulnerabilities that that can create, both at a family level and an individual level. And they really were quite scared. And actually, that's a scary place to be, because they've then got to go and find people they can trust to provide the advice. And as we all know, as we all see, there are good advisors and bad advisors. So identifying the ones that you can genuinely trust to give you the advice you need at the time that you need it is another pitfall that people need to be wary of. And it comes down to me in one simple fact, which is if you don't invest in the preparation of your next generation, you are creating the environment for a car crash.
So it isn't just about my favourite word from earlier, communication. It's also about inclusion or involvement. So getting the family members involved in dealing with, in handling the wealth at an early stage. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think yes. And I think it extends beyond that. It's actually, I think these discussions are very instrumental in defining a family's purpose. And you know, we all need a purpose. It doesn't matter whether it's a, you know, a teenager coming out of school wondering what they're going to do. What gets us out of bed in the morning is having a clear purpose. What motivates us is having a clear purpose. That is exactly the same, my conviction is it's exactly the same in a family context. A family needs to have a clear purpose. And actually, going back to your first point, if you have that purpose, when your founder passes, that purpose becomes your glue. It's something that the family can bind around.
Well, there's the practitioner's viewpoint. Graham, I wonder, is your purpose being one of the top wealth litigators in London?
It may be my purpose. I think everything John's been saying is right to a point, in the sense of this, that you quite often find that there are what are known as family jewel assets, which have been built up by the matriarch, and then become the purpose. And that's not right for trustees. The purpose of a trust is not to keep the family asset. It's to consider what's in the best interests of the beneficiaries at all times, from time to time. The way that I often see this is that you find that there was a family business which was built up by the patriarch or matriarch that a certain element of the family are involved with, that they live their life as a result of that purpose, and the rest of them are excluded. And so you end up with beneficiaries that see the purpose and beneficiaries that see very little. And there's a sort of jealousy that then is created between the two. I remember I had a case involving someone from Paris 25 years ago when we were both young. And what that is exactly that had happened. They had a family business, which some of the beneficiaries were involved with. They saw it as their purpose. And then a whole group of beneficiaries that saw nothing and then looked at how much money they were making out of the business, what it was that they were getting out of it. And in the end, the value was unlocked by selling the business so that all the beneficiaries could benefit. But it created, I think it's useful for a period, but then you've got to be careful of who's within the scope of the purpose and who falls outside. And that's probably because I mainly see dysfunctional families. That's what happens or can happen.
And when you see that, you must, Simon, over your 39 years, I'm going to keep reminding you
Thank
of that,
you.
these 39 years of being a trustee, when generations shift, when the glue is gone, how do you keep families together? How do you avoid the kind of dispute that Graham's just been talking about?
In this context, we're talking about acting as trustee, I think, whilst there's lots of solutions to wealth management in a trust capacity, this is actually where a trustee can really help. I've been in situations where, unfortunately, there is conflict and disputes within the family and those arguments. And that's where you do need a strong trustee to sort of sit above that. If you've got the continuity, which is something we've not really spoken about, where someone is in that trusted role, who knew that the wealth curator knew exactly how that conflict should be managed, then it's somewhat easier. It's not always perfect because there's always scope for that dispute to continue. And we do see it from time to time. You know, expensive litigation, which again is not really good for the family cause, is it? Because lots of money goes on your lawyer fees rather than to the family. But yeah, you know, it does happen. In my experience, mostly it doesn't, because we sort of do, you know, you try and do the right thing, do all the things that we've just spoken about in terms of communication and that understanding, you know, that family. But when there is fallout, it can be a challenge. But the answer to your question is being strong, having the advantage of actually knowing, you know, whether it was the matriarch or patriarch or even the grandfather or mother, and you can sit in front of the family and say, I can remember having this conversation with your father or with your mother, and this is what they really would have wanted and not what you're trying to do. So it helps. It's not always the perfect solution, because if someone's sort of dogmatic in trying to drive through their own objective, then that doesn't often help. But let's not forget, if we're talking about, you know, a trust role, it's a trustee decision at the end of the day. They can hear all the different feedback, the comments, you know, that they have, but at the end of the day, someone has to make that decision. Again, talking in the role of a trustee would be what that trustee would do.
There's no substitute for a serious, qualified, but firm fiduciary. John, do you want to add to that?
No, it's true. And I think Simon's point is well made. And I think it is part of a journey. And I think, you know, we've all spoken about it many times before and including today. But I think this issue around consultation, review, getting it from the horse's mouth, for want of a better expression, being able to relate that to a family whenever it's needed, is immensely powerful. And I think the other thing people forget when they do any form of planning, actually, is because of the complexity of the modern families, as Melody highlighted earlier, is you frequently get today that there's a much higher degree in some of these situations of what I fondly refer to as, frankly, emotional baggage. And we should never underestimate the power of emotion, because that also needs to be factored into all of our thinking and a family's thinking when they're thinking about how they plan their succession and wealth transfers. Because when it comes to it, when an event happens, for quite a long time, quite often, decisions are driven by emotion and the heart rather than the head. And preempting that and trying to mitigate that as far as reasonably possible is really important. You will never entirely remove it from the equation, but you can limit its impact.
Well, that's a good segue for me, John, to talk about the vulnerable. And you're always going to have vulnerable people in family contexts. It doesn't need to go so far as people who don't have mental capacity. But Melody, what do you do if you think you've got a vulnerable client, a family member who may not have mental capacity anymore? What sort of issue does that throw up for you as a trust advisor?
Well, I think one of the main issues here is actually identifying the issue when it arises. You know, good advisors, they meet with their principals a lot, but people are very good at hiding difficulties that they're having. As John was saying, people often think with the heart and not the head. And actually, people aren't realistic with themselves. Someone will come to you and say, I've got this principled objection to something that's happening in the business. And what they really mean is, my father was rude to me at Christmas. And that happens when people sort of have full mental capacity, but when they're placed in really stressful situations within the family, that happens even more. And as now we're aging, people are starting to still be quite active in life, but with the starts of cognitive decline. And particularly wealth creators, entrepreneurs, business people, they're good at hiding that. And identifying it can be really hard. And as Simon says, this is where you need a strong trustee or a strong fiduciary to come in, to recognize the problem, to know, because they've been acting with this family for years, this is not quite normal. This is not quite how they'd be acting. And to have the confidence to actually ask the questions, to find out what the issue is.
Goodness, John, how on earth do you put that kind of question to somebody you've known for years? Melody, I think you've lost the plot. What do you do?
I mean, it's difficult. And I think it's a question of, you know, it's our responsibility as a part of the advisory community to ensure, and I think Melody raised it right at the very beginning of this chat, is engaging with these families and the wealth creators continually is a very important component of what we should all be doing. And that's not to be intrusive. It's not to be nosy. It's a question of growing with that family and be part of that journey with them in order that if things do start to go off the rails slightly, or there are indications that they might, that one, you're able to spot them early, two, you can then start to do something about it. But I think actually one of the best quotes I can remember was a particular client of mine. He was very preoccupied. He had two split family, the modern family. I'm split family myself, so I understand the dynamic. He asked me one day a very powerful question. It's a very short question, but he simply looked at me in the eye and said, John, who is going to protect me from me?
That's a really good question. Have you come across that kind of question as a litigator, Graham?
The ones that I tend to come across are who controls me when I've lost the ability to control myself in terms of capacity. So, I mean, from a litigator, it's sort of double trouble because you have the control issues and the family fighting as to who's got control of the matriarch and patriarch and what decisions are they taking during the latter part of their life. And then you've got then the second round of it when they've died. And, you know, there are some quite famous instances of that, say the Stanley Ho matter, where, you know, they lived well into the 90s, late 90s, and there were all sorts of issues as to who was controlling who. It seems to be a thing that happens a lot in Asia. And there are a number of quite significant families where this has happened. And there's allegations of abduction over the, you know, the elderly relative who's the wealth creator. That is an issue that we come across quite a lot, and it is really problematic. And if you're a fiduciary having control of the wealth and these sorts of things are going on, it's a real problem, because you will find that there'll be court proceedings and there'll be all sorts of things about, not just about who's controlling the assets, but the welfare of that person becomes a major issue. And you'd often end up with corporate protection issues as well as in the Chancery Division.
It's a sad truth, isn't it, that we end up talking about litigation. But are there any alternatives to litigation that actually work, Graham?
I think provided that, I mean, it's the question that John raised, you need the processes put in place before it happens. So the more planning that can go into what happens when I can no longer look after myself, the more chance you've got of actually having a sensible solution. One of the issues is that, you know, people don't think they're going to die. They don't think they're going to lose capacity. They don't do anything about it. And then the family all suspect each other of controlling for their own ends. And the really important thing is that actually there's a lot of planning that goes into before that happens. So I think John's absolutely right.
Yeah, I think my expression I use is plan for the worst, but the worst is not to plan.
I'm thrown back to what I was taught when I was taught advocacy, and I was told, don't be a Christopher Columbus. I thought, what on earth does that mean? Well, what happened with Christopher Columbus? When he set out, he didn't know where he was going. When he got there, he didn't know where he was. And when he got home, he didn't know where he'd been. All because he didn't have a plan. That's it for today's episode. Thanks very much to our brilliant guests, Melody Munro and Graham Kleiner, and to you for listening. We will be back next time to explore specific points to keep track of when everything seems to be all right.
Generally speaking, I will actually say to the gatekeepers, we can't do a proper job unless we have access to the family members. The family members, of course, have asked the gatekeepers to get the governance and the planning sorted out. And that's where the problem lies.
We went through the process of creating a family constitution and agreeing a new governance framework. And we reflected at the end with them, how has this experience been for you? And they said the experience has been really valuable because it's enabled us to communicate together. It's actually brought us together. It's made us communicate in a different way.
I think as you move through generations, the challenge for every family, it doesn't matter how wealthy one is or how wealthy one isn't, uniting around a purpose is really important.
Make sure you follow The Wealth Chat wherever you're listening to this right now to be the first to know when that episode is available. Until the next time, goodbye.